with us this past week and for the next week, is it? For 2 weeks. We have Ann Ludlam and Tom O'Connell, two artists in residence, if you will, theatrical people, directors, playwrights, experts on all sorts of things. Next week, those of you who are going to be here are going to be treated to some time with Emily Dickinson. I'd like to come back. But tonight, we're going to have a presentation, the wooing scene from Richard III. So sit back, and our feedback will be our enjoyment and our applause.
Thank you.
Samuel Taylor Coleridge once wrote about the willing suspension of disbelief, which is another way of saying that everybody likes to make believe. Think of the construction of make believe. We make ourselves believe. Well, tonight we're going to give you the acid test of the willing suspension of disbelief, because we're going to ask you to believe a lot of things. For starters, would you believe that here on the hearth, which is no longer a hearth, is a coffin? It is the coffin which contains the body of King Henry VI of England. It is an open coffin halfway down, and he is resting there in peace. Can everybody see him?
Yeah.
Good. Good. For starters, that's great. We ask you to believe that I am Richard III and Annie is Lady Anne. Lady Anne is a woman, a strong woman, a woman of conviction, and yet in this scene she falls victim to the wiles of Richard. Richard is, among other things, a deformed person physically. The way I play him, he has a humpback, his left side is not quite right, and he therefore will drag his back foot. He is also a distorted person mentally, in that he is, if anybody in literature or history ever has been, is a pure villain. It is hard to find anything really good to say about him. He is pure Beelzebub. But for all that, if I do him right, you ought to find something curiously likable about him. See if you do. Maybe the flaw is in us, that somebody who is quite as wily, quite as unconscionable, quite as pure devil, pure evil, as Richard should have a likable side to him. At the very opening of the play, Richard is talking to his audience. He is setting the scene for the play, in which he states that he is very unhappy with the present situation in England because it is too peaceful. Richard is a warrior. He is ugly. He is strong. He is ruthless. And he is therefore a good warrior. And in times of war, he's an effective person. In time of peace, he's bored. So, he's groping in this opening soliloquy about what he should do about his boredom. And he decides that, well, maybe it'd be interesting to become a villain, a pure villain. And to have a more tangible goal, he decides that he will seek to gain the crown of England. A neat trick, because he's 5 or 6 or 7 steps removed from the throne. Not to worry, he handles it in a very straightforward fashion. He kills them all. He kills the king. He kills the king's son. He kills 2 little boys in the castle who stand between him and the crown. He is about as ruthless a killer as you could imagine. But there is one person who stands between him and the crown, the throne of England, whom he must deal with in a slightly more subtle fashion, and that is Lady Anne. So instead of his usual method of killing her, he marries her. Now, he doesn't marry her by force. He's got no authority over her. On the contrary, in a sense, she ranks him. She is the daughter of the prince, the heir apparent, recently deceased, at Richard's hand. She is a good, strong person, and yet, in the scene that we are to do, you are to believe that he is actually successful in wooing and winning her. He does this in spite of the fact that at one point, in the very early part of the scene, she is so full of hatred for him in the presence of the king that she spits at him. Get ready. However, through his wiles, through his strength, through his capacity to use language effectively, which nobody ever did better than Shakespeare, he is capable of wooing her. Let me give you first off, before I go into any other aspects of the introduction or have Annie make any points she wants to that she thinks you might need in order to get us through the scene, then what we want to do afterward is to discuss the scene with you, to get your reactions, and to have some give and take about the scene. But let me give you his introductory soliloquy. Ah, yes, I ask you to believe that I am deformed, that I am ugly and hateful. My costume? My REI jacket.
During this pause, we should thank Christina, who is not only doing wardrobe, she did lights. She's helping us with lines. She's on the book. General stage manager and house manager.
Yes, we have asked Christina to follow the book because this might be called a work in progress or in reprogress. This is a scene that we have done before, but we haven't done it for a long time. So we will be more secure, and you will be more secure with somebody on book. If we need a little help with this somewhat tricky scene, particularly with respect to language, we shall simply call line, and Christina will give us the line. Not to worry, simply exercise your willing suspension of disbelief and pretend it didn't happen. All right, in the opening soliloquy then, Richard is decrying the what he calls the weak piping time of peace, and is saying that he liked it much better in wartime. He speaks with scorn of the piping time of peace, and he determines that he will prove a villain. So here's the opening soliloquy.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful dances. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front. And now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fight the souls of its fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor meant to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by then, why, I in this weak piping time of peace have no delight to pass away the time, unless to see my shadow in the sun, and descant upon mine own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover to entertain these fair, well-spoken dames, I am determined to prove a villain and hate the idle pleasures of these days. He then goes on, in that soliloquy, of which that's only part, to explain point by point by point what he's going to do, and that's exactly what indeed he does do. The exception being how he handles Lady Anne, which he has to be very careful with in this scene. This incredible scene, one of the things that we like about it is that it is on paper incredible, and yet he carries it off. Watch and see how. Anything else we should say by way of introduction?
Yes, we should say more suspension of disbelief. This is the casket. Henry the VI is there, open halfway down. At one point, do we say that?
Sure. We mentioned about Henry the VI. Go ahead. He's your father-in-law.
He's my father-in-law. At one point, the corpse bleeds, and it was assumed in medieval times that if a corpse bled, it was because the murderer was in the room. And also, Richard is wearing a dagger there, a murderous falchion.
A long, curved dagger, deadly, right there.
And he has a ring, which he takes off at one point. And
nice, huh? I think that does it. Let's go for it.
Okay.
Well, we should just say that in the very opening of the scene, Lady Anne, whose duty it is as the daughter-in-law, extant, to take the coffin of the king to the cemetery, comes in to commence with her duties, to have men follow her to take the corpse to the appropriate cemetery.
Poor key-cold figure of a holy king. Pale ashes of the House of Lancaster. Thou bloodless remnant of that royal blood. Is it lawful that I invocate thy ghost to hear the lamentations of poor Anne, wife to thy Edward? Thy slaughtered son, stabbed by the self-same hand that made these holes. Oh, in these windows that let forth thy life, I pour the helpless balm of my poor eyes. Oh, cursed be the hand that made these holes. Cursed the heart that had the heart to do it. Cursed the blood that let this blood from hence. More direful hap betide that hated wretch. It makes us wretched by the death of thee than I can hope to adders, spiders, toads, or any creeping venom thing that lived. If ever he had child, aborted be it, prodigious and untimely brought to light, whose ugly and unnatural aspect may fright the hopeful mother at the view. Whatever he have, wife, let her be made more miserable by the death of him than I am made by my young lord and thee. Avaunt, thou dreadful minister of hell! Thou hast but power over his mortal body. His soul thou canst not have, therefore be gone!
Sweet saint, for charity, be not so cursed!
Foul devil,
For God's sake, hence, and trouble us no more. But thou hast made the happy earth thy hell, filled it with cursing cries and deep exclaims. If thou delight to view thy heinous deeds, behold this pattern of thy butchery. Oh! Look and see. Did Henry's wounds open their congealed mouths and bleed afresh? Blush! Blush, thou lump of foul deformity! What is thy presence that exhales this blood from cold and empty veins where no blood dwells? Thy deed, inhuman and unnatural, provokes this deluge most unnatural. O God, which this blood makes to revenge his death! O earth, which this blood drinks to revenge his death! By the heaven, with lightning, strike the murderer dead, or earth, gape open wide and eat him quick, lest thou dost swallow up this good king's blood,
please,
which his hell-governed arm hath butchered.
You know no rules of charity, which renders good for bad, blessings for curses.
Villain! Thou knowest no rule of God nor man. No beast so fierce but knows some touch of pity.
But I know none, and therefore I know beast.
Oh, wonderful. When devils tell the truth.
More wonderful when angels are so angry. And vouchsafe divine perfection of a woman of these supposed evils to give me leave by circumstance but to acquit myself.
Vouchsafe diffused infection of a man for these known evils but to give me leave by circumstance to curse thy cursed self.
Fairer than tongue can name thee, let me have some patient leisure to excuse myself.
Fouler than heart can think thee, thou canst make no excuse current but to hang thyself.
By such despair I should accuse myself.
And by despairing shalt thou stand excused for doing worthy vengeance on thyself that didst unworthy slaughter upon others.
Say that I slew them not.
Then say they were not slain. But dead they are, and devilish slave by thee.
I did not kill your husband.
Why, then he is alive.
Nay, he's dead, and slain by Edward's hand.
Foul throat, thou liest. Queen Margaret saw thy murderous falchion smoking in his blood, the which thou once did turn against her breast, but that thy brothers beat aside the point.
Ah. I was provoked by her slanderous tongue that laid their guilt upon my guiltless shoulders.
Thou wast provoked by thy bloody mind that never dreamt on aught but butcheries. Didst thou not kill this king?
I grant you.
Dost grant me, hedgehog? Then God grant me too. Line.
Thou mayst be damned.
Thou mayst be damned for that wicked deed. Oh, he was gentle, mild, and virtuous.
The fitter for the King of Heaven that hath him.
He is in heaven, where thou shalt never come.
Let him thank me that hope to send him thither, for he was fitter for that place than earth.
And thou unfit for any place but hell.
Yes. One place else, if you will hear me name it.
Some dungeon.
Your bedchamber.
He'll rest betide the chamber where thou liest.
So will it, madam, till I lie with you.
I hope so.
I know so. But, gentle Lady Anne, to leave this keen encounter of our wits and fall somewhat into a slower method, is not the causer of the timeless deaths of these Plantagenets, Henry and Edward, as blameful as the executioner?
Thou wast the cause, and most accursed effect.
Your beauty was the cause of that effect. Your beauty that did prompt me to kill the whole world, if need be, to spend 1 hour in your sweet bosom.
If I thought that, I tell thee, homicide, these nails would rend that beauty from my cheeks.
You should not blemish it if I stood by. As all the world is cheered by the sun, so I by that. It is my day, my life.
Black night or shade thy day. And death thy life.
Curse not thyself, fair creature. Thou art both.
I would I were to be revenged on thee.
It is a quarrel most unnatural to be revenged on him that loveth thee.
It is a quarrel just and reasonable to be revenged on he who killed my husband.
He that bereft thee, lady, of thy husband, did it to help thee to a better husband.
His better doth not breathe upon the earth.
He lives that loves thee better than he could.
Name him.
Plantagenet.
Why, that was he.
The selfsame name, but one of better nature.
Where is he?
Here. Why dost thou spit at me?
Would it were mortal poison for thy sake.
Never came poison from so sweet a place.
Never hung poison on a fouler toe. Out of my sight. Thou dost infect mine eyes.
Thine eyes, sweet lady, have infected mine.
But they were basilisks to strike thee dead.
Would they were that I might die at once, for now they kill me with a living death. Those eyes of thine from mine have drawn salt tears. Shame their aspect with store of childish drops. These eyes which never shed remorseful tear. No. When my father York and Edward wept to hear the piteous moan that Rutland made when black-faced Clifford shook his sword at him. Nor when thy warlike father, like a child, told the sad story of my father's death. And 20 times made pause to sob and weep that all the standers-by had wet their cheeks like trees bedashed with rain. In that sad time, my manly eyes did scorn an humble tear. And what those sorrows could not thence exhale, thy beauty hath then made them blind with weeping. I never sued to friend or enemy. My tongue could never learn sweet, smoothing word. But now thy beauty is proposed by thee, my proud heart sues and prompts my tongue to speak. Teach not thy lips such scorn, for it was made for kissing, lady, not for such contempt. If thy revengeful heart cannot forgive, lo, here I lend thee this sharp-pointed sword, which if thou please to hide in this true breast and let the soul forth that adoreth thee, I lay it naked to the deadly stroke, and humbly beg the death upon my knee. Nay, do not pause, 'twas I that killed King Henry. But 'twas thy beauty that provoked me. Nay, now dispatched, 'twas I that killed your Edward. But 'twas thy heavenly face that set me on. Take up the sword again, or take up me.
Arise, December. Although I wish thy death, I will not be thy executioner.
Then bid me kill myself, and I will do it.
I have already.
That was in thy rage. Speak it again, and even with the word, this hand, which for thy love did kill thy love, shall for thy love kill a far truer love. To both their deaths shall love be accessory.
I would I knew your heart.
'Tis figured in my tongue.
I fear me both are false.
Then never man was true.
Well. Put up your sword.
Say then my peace is made.
That shalt thou know hereafter.
But shall I live in hope?
All men, I hope, live so.
Folks say to wear this ring.
Take is not to give.
Look how this ring encompasseth thy finger. Even so, thy breast encloseth my poor heart.
Wear both of them, for both of them are thine. And if thy poor devoted servant may but one beg one favor of thy gracious heart, I will be happy forever.
What is it?
That it may please you. Leave these sad designs to him that has more cause to be a mourner, and presently repair to Crosby Place, where, after I have solemnly interred at Chertsey Monastery this noble king, and wet his grave with my repentant tears, I will with all expedient duty see you. For divers unknown reasons, I beseech you, grant me this boon.
With all my heart, and much it joys me too, to see you are become so penitent.
Bid me farewell.
It is more than you deserve. But since you teach me how to flatter you, imagine I have said farewell already.
Was ever woman in this humor wooed? Was ever woman in this humor won? I'll have her, but I will not keep her long. What? I that killed her husband and his father? To take her in her heart's extremest hate? With curses in her mouth, tears in her eye, the bleeding witness of her hatred by, having God, her conscience, and all these bars against me, and I no friends to back my suit with all but the plain devil and dissembling looks, and yet to win her, all the world to nothing? Ha! Hath she forgot already that brave Prince Edward, her lord, whom I, some 3 months since, stabbed in my angry mood at Tewkesbury? Oh, lovelier and sweeter gentleman, the world has never known. Young, valiant, the best of the princes. And will she yet abase her eyes on me, that cropped the golden prime of this sweet prince, and made her widow to a woeful bed? On me, whose all not equals Edward's moiety? On me, that halt and am misshapen thus? My dukedom to a beggarly denier! I do mistake my person all this while. Upon my life she finds, though I cannot, myself to be a marvelous proper man. I'll bid charges for a looking glass, and entertain a score or two of tailors to study fashions, to adorn my body. Since I am crept in favor with myself, I will maintain it with some little cost. But first, I'll turn this fellow in his grave. And then return, lamenting, to my love. Shine out, fair sun, till I have bought a glass, that I may see my shadow as I pass.
Do now is to discuss the scene a bit further with you and answer any questions you may have about it. I didn't mention, and I might have done, that, as I think you would agree, it is good drama, but it is not good history. The accuracy of the portrayal of Richard III by Shakespeare has been debated ever since the play was first written. It's very enigmatical as to the degree to which he was indeed a villain. There are controversial books on both sides of that question that have been written almost since Shakespeare's own time and raging to the current time. So, I won't vouch for the actual character of Richard as an historical figure, but I do enjoy playing that evil devil on the stage. Are there questions or aspects of it that you would like to discuss or comment on, or questions that you have about how we put it together or whatever?
Well, historically, how does Anne stand in the way of the throne? Isn't she just by marriage in that line?
Yeah, she was married to, in effect, the Duke of Wales, the Prince of Wales.
So the Prince of Wales dies, doesn't go to the wife, does it?
No.
So how does she stand in his way?
I think his fear is that if she should have a child, that child would have a right to the throne, and nobody trusts anybody.
He's also walking a real tightrope politically. He's not just killing people. He's also trying to keep some people behind him on his side of the issue of who shall succeed the king.
What he does more with her is neutralize it. She's no longer a potential enemy, and in the play, what Shakespeare does is get all these women against him, including his own mother. So the wonderful scenes where all the women are lamenting what he's doing, and there's always the sense that they might get together and start really causing trouble for him, although they never do. I saw a production at Ashland that about 4 years ago, and John Elwood played Richard. And the beginning of it, I just thought was wonderful. It was in Ashland, Oregon, and it was in the traditional Shakespeare stage. And what they did was they opened all the little doors and all the little windows, and the beginning of the play was people just kind of looking out and looking at each other, and walking around and checking to see who was there, and then going and telling this person. And there were no words, but you just had the feeling of the Nixon White House kind of thing. And I thought that was a great beginning to the play. Unfortunately, the production didn't keep that up. But I think if you have that feeling of everybody is liable to connive with anybody else against anybody else, and so you make an ally of anyone you can, it gives the right kind of setting for the action.
Other questions or comments about any aspect of this?
Of course, the reason that Shakespeare wrote it this way was he was heading toward writing Henry VIII and setting up, and actually, the Henry who comes in at the end of this play and takes over is Henry VII, who is the first Tudor, and Shakespeare was trying to make it seem as if the Tudors were the good guys. And so in order to make the Tudors be the good guys, he had to make the Yorks and the Lancastrians be the bad guys. So he painted all these people pretty poorly, pretty badly, as if they were bad.
Did the play actually have a political effect in reality? Or?
Sure, because what it did was, at the time of Elizabeth, what it did was say, Elizabeth is really legitimate. She really is the person that we should have, because she is a legitimate queen, because she is a Tudor, and...
Because otherwise we'd have the progeny of this monster. You see,
right.
So indirectly, obliquely, Shakespeare's making a political point.
And also, historically too, then the Tudors married the Yorks and married the Lancasters to pull it all together, so that the power became cemented, and you didn't have these factions all over England saying, "Well, we want to be king." and we want to rule. And the, you know, the efforts in Elizabeth's time to make it one country and make it cohesive were just amazing. Her trips through England were fantastic, and
progress,
and her father's too, Henry VIII's, where they would set off with hundreds of people and go and visit castles, you know, noblemen and distant relations, and those relations would then have to entertain them for a couple of weeks and give parties and give plays and have feasts and so forth. But it really made everything come together. I mean, it was better than the Democratic Convention. Work together and feel that they were all one, which was what they needed.
Yes, miss.
You like to especially play Shakespeare, and how do you memorize those lines?
Yeah, sometimes not perfectly.
Yes. To quote Emily Dickinson, the ultimate source of all wisdom, one time when she was in Boston with problems with her eyes, she was forbidden to read. And when she came back to Amherst, Massachusetts, having been given the dispensation by her doctor that she could commence to read, she started off with Antony and Cleopatra. She went through Shakespeare. And she wrote to a friend at the time, "Why do we bother with anybody else? He's that much bigger than anybody else. Everybody else has competition. Who's the greatest composer? Bach? Mozart? Beethoven? Who's your favorite?" Well, you find a lot of differences. But most people, particularly the real theater pros and buffs, most people say, no question, Shakespeare. And that would be true whether they be English or non-English. True in Spain, by and large. You'd get some votes for Lope de Vega and Calderon, but by and large, you would say Shakespeare is the greatest ever. So he's great fun to play, and there is an easier part about memorizing his lines than you might think, and that is there is a rhythm to them. It is, in effect, poetry. It does have a swing to it. Most of Shakespeare is written in a rhythmical vein, which, in effect, makes it poetry. And therefore, it's easier to memorize because the sequence is right. Indeed, if it sounds halting, you know you're wrong. You haven't got it right. And you go back and you get the rhythm right and you get the line right. But there's no secret to memorizing lines except to slug away and work at it. Other question or comment? Yes, Nancy?
Annie, I want to know what you do with your character.
Well, I think I was thinking about her today. And I was thinking of what Herb Ruther said yesterday in his session, and he said that we mustn't say that Hitler was crazy and we mustn't say that Stalin was crazy, because when we do that, we deny our mutual humanity and we deny the fact that we could be Hitler-like or we could be Stalin-like. And we could also be Lady Anne-like. I mean, I think if we were in a situation, if we were in what I know basically most intimately is Latin America, but I could imagine being in a Latin American country when there was enormous upheaval and the power was apparently going to one person, and unless you were allied with that one person, you would have no protection and no security, and if you were on an island, which of course they were in England, there was no way to get out. I think there would be an awful lot of forces working within you to see your way to ally yourself with that person. And that implication of being part of the guilt of having, you know, when he says it was your beauty that caused it. Well, you know, I mean, I think we could find ourselves in situations where we would believe that.
Do you believe that Shakespeare attributed that vanity more to women?
I don't know.
I would say not.
I would say not. I would say that that Richard used men the same way he used Lady Anne, by playing on their vanity. No, the last thing Shakespeare was a chauvinist, simply because he saw the human being too clearly to say, these are better, these are not as good. He saw flaws and virtues in both sexes and all classes of people. He is universal. And therefore, I think you'd be hard-pressed to make a case for that. And I certainly don't see it in my reading of Shakespeare.
Didn't you show Richard as being vanity, you know, the clothes and all that?
Absolutely vain. Absolutely vain. No question about it. His ego is without bounds. As we see through the play, he just is absolutely without limit in his ego. Now, he's pure id, combined with ego. There's no superego there, whatever. Yes?
It seemed from the way that you played Anne that she really didn't respond to the appeal to her vanity, that really she was just seizing upon this opportunity to protect herself by aligning herself with him.
I think that's what I was feeling more, right. And it isn't so much her vanity, it's the guilt by... it's, you know, I mean, it's like... I'll tell you what it's similar to. It's similar to... the feeling that... that a woman has if she has been attacked. You know, it's partly her fault. It's partly her... I think she feels, well, maybe that's right. Maybe it is partly my fault. I don't think it is the vanity. I don't think she thinks, at least I can't play it, that she feels, oh, I am so dazzlingly beautiful that I'm always causing these problems around the court. but the feeling that, oh, you know, if I hadn't been there, right, maybe I am in some way to blame for this. Inadvertently, let it be. Yeah. But the feeling, to me, I was more conscious this time of being caught in a situation where you've got to go where the protection is.
One of the things that Annie did differently than some of what she's done before, I think, might have given that feeling. When she sat, she presented an obstacle to me as I was trying to play upon her vanity. Usually the line where I feel I got it, where I say, your beauty was the cause of that effect. Your beauty prompted me to do all these horrendous things. That's when she starts to teeter. In this one, somehow it didn't quite play that way, and partially it was because that was the way Annie was seated, and it was the way she chose to be seated, which is consistent with her character. And I still found a way to play around that, because you ought to have the sense that if one thing doesn't work, Richard tries another. You know, you've got a million tricks up here. In here, in this pocket, that pocket, in the shoe, you know, a card up the sleeve. He'll try anything. And that one usually seems to me to be the one that works the best. But in this production, this particular performance, it didn't. And one of the things that's fun about a scene like this is it's never quite the same. It's always a little different. We're always learning about a scene like this, no matter how many times we've done it or rehearsed it or had it critiqued by friends as we're working it through. It's always different. And of course, a lot of it depends, and it's the magic of the theater, is that it depends upon you. The way you reacted in large measure determined how we played. Much more than you probably are aware, much more than I'm aware ever when I'm in the audience. But when I'm playing, and especially where we're playing a scene like this that is so much a three-way thing, see, I'm playing to Annie, but I'm feeling your reactions. And if I feel that I really got you with one approach, I'll stay with it a little bit. And if I feel that I'm losing you a little bit, I'll try a different tack. So that's part of the fun of it. You wonder how people can play a part for months and months and months. Well, if it's an interesting piece like Shakespeare, every night is different. Every house is different. And that's the fun. That's the fun, to continue to do it as well as you can.
What American play would you most enjoy playing?
The one that Annie, I'll let Annie speak for herself, the one that Annie and I have done that I think is my favorite ever, and certainly my favorite with Annie, would be The Glass Menagerie. We talked a little bit about that in some of our other sessions. But Annie and I did the gentleman caller scene from The Glass Menagerie, which is my favorite scene. It's the perfect scene written by an American. And the play is pretty close to the perfect play. And we did that one time, and that was a high point. What would you say?
To play, I'd take a bash at Amanda in Glass Menagerie. That would be fun. I think that probably the best American play is Our Town.
Yes.
Which I can't really play in that play, but I sure could direct it. And I didn't see that play. I mean, I can't believe this, until I was like 45 and I had taught theater in a high school for 7 years. I had simply never seen a production of it. And I went out to see it. We lived then in Massachusetts. I went to see it at the Williamstown Summer Theater. And Geraldine Fitzgerald was playing the stage manager. One was playing the stage manager. I was absolutely knocked out by the play. Of course, I'd read it, and I had directed scenes of it and so forth in my own classes, but I'd never seen the whole play. Well, I was absolutely knocked out. And I made everybody go and see it as if nobody had ever seen that play before in their lives. You know? I made you go, I made our son go.
That was the first and only time on record that the stage manager has been played by a woman. And Annie has ever since then been trying to inveigle her way into playing that role.
Yeah, I could play the stage manager.
Which is one of the great roles. But certainly Arthur Miller, we have to talk about Arthur Miller. We're talking about the great playwrights and the great plays. And we talked a little bit in one of our other sessions, you may recall, about the recent Death of a Salesman production. I suppose if you had to pick a play that the consensus would build around as the great American play, it would be that. It would be Willie Loman's Dilemma, which neither of us has ever played. Now what I would really like to do would be Sam Shepard. Sam Shepard, I think, has taken the mantle from Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams as the American playwright, and his work is endlessly fascinating to me. So I've never played him. I would love to play some Sam Shepard.
What are some of his plays?
Well, his most recent play is A Lie of the Mind, which won all the prizes in New York this past season. And I suppose we might as well get right out on the table that we are biased in that one because our daughter played one of the leads. Amanda Plummer played the lead when it opened, and then our daughter succeeded her for the rest of the run. And so we are biased. But it's a terribly moving play.
He's also seen the play a lot.
Yes.
You have such a beautiful voice. Would you sing something for us?
Goodness gracious.
I put you on the spot.
Well, the only song that I would have really ready to sing, because I haven't been thinking about singing, is the one that I sang yesterday, and I don't know.
Okay.
Is that?
Good.
Well, this is to switch signals completely then. This is to do a song which is in a way related to Richard. I see a link quickly, and that is that Richard used a kind of abusive power that is not dissimilar to that which was the situation in Mexico prior to the revolution in Mexico, and that is what is called in Spanish el derecho del señor, by which the patron, the feudal lord, and there was a feudal lord in effect in Mexico up until the revolution in the early days of this century, would have the right and exercised the right to something that Richard might do. Spend the first night with any young woman after she was married. If you stop and think about that, it's about as horrendous abuse of power as there could be. But it was systematically abused in Mexico. Indeed, if you could point to one thing and say that abuse was the cause of the Mexican Revolution, that would be it. And one testimony to that is the song that I will sing for you is La Borrachita, which is about such a scene. And it was the song that echoed throughout Mexico during those horrendous years of the Mexican Revolution. La Borrachita means the little drunken girl. Borracho is drunk. La Borrachita is a little drunken girl. And the little drunken girl has learned at her wedding that she will indeed be subject to this outrageous abuse. She will have to spend the first night with the patron, the feudal lord. Her husband has told her this. She has had some drinks. She's not used to drinking. She's a very young girl. She's drinking the wine, the festive wine of the wedding. And she gets drunk. And he's explaining to her more. He's explaining to her that he tried to arrange it, that this wouldn't have to happen. But the alternative clearly was for him to be killed. He tried to talk the patron into letting him go away with her. The patron said no. So I will sing you this revolutionary song, which tells that story. And it's the bridegroom singing to the bride. Borrachita, me voy para olvidarte. Te quiero mucho, también me quieres. Borrachita, me voy hasta la capital para servirle al patrón que me mandó llamar. Anteayer yo te quise traer. Dijo que no, que se había que llorar hasta volver. Borrachita me voy hasta la capital para servirle patrón que me mando llamar ante ayer.